You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting program of the Around the Block presented by Federal Prison Authority. I'm Bruce Cameron along with Susan Giddings. Boy, we have an exciting show for you today. We are going to talk about a topic that is on the minds of thousands of our members and subscribers and YouTube people and Facebook but we're going to talk about detainers and pending charges.
Well, and we've been trying to talk about it for a couple of weeks, and other stuff have popped up that we needed to.
Other stuff comes in front of it. But, you know, that age-old question is, can I still release to a halfway house or community placement with a detainer or some sort of a pending charge? So,
right.
We'll let Susan take it.
And just put in an official plug for the Green Book. Unlocking federal prison destination custody classification. Got it right here. And because we talk about pending charges and detainers, and we talk about it from the very beginning, we talk about it in the context of how the pre-sentence investigation report is written. So when someone's looking at that pre-sentence investigation report, you know, we've got the offense conduct, the current thing. And then you have a section that says pending charges. And then you've got that criminal history. And then you've got this other section that they call other arrests, right? Mm-hmm. And from the sentencing court, you know, all they're looking at is criminal history points. Were points right. assigned or not? Because obviously you take the points and your base score and you throw that together and you got a range in terms of the offense. And when people, and it's just a reality, probation writes that pre-sentence investigation for the courts. Defense attorneys are looking at sentencing guidelines and criminal history points, and no one is paying attention to what the Bureau looks at. And except we are, which is why we wrote the book, because we kept seeing these problems come up. Mm-hmm. So when the Bureau gets a pre-sentence investigation report, this is, you know, after sentencing, after probation releases a report to the marshals then send those documents to the Bureau along with a request to designate. The Bureau looks at every single history item, whether it's officially being labeled as a pending charge, whether it's a history item, whether it's a other arrest. Mm-hmm. They're looking at everything, and they're looking at the dispositions, right? And if anything looks open and unresolved, right, there could be a warrant for an individual out there. On initial designation, they're scoring it as a detainer. We understand it's not a detainer. It's not a formally lodged detainer. But for classification purposes, for initial classification purposes, if there is anything that appears open, they are going to score that accordingly. Now, something a lot of folks might not think about, you had a charge and you got a probation, 5 years of probation. It's an old thing. You're on non-reporting status. The Bureau is going to look at the sentencing date, the disposition of where you were ordered 5 years probation. And if your arrest on the current offense is within that five-year window, they will assume that you have a possible probation violation or a possible parole violation. Parole violations can have a longer lead time. If you get a 20-year sentence, you serve 10 and are paroled. The assumption is, and while there could be variation from state to state, the Bureau is going to assume that the remaining 10 years, I should say presume, the remaining 10 years is all parole, which means if 8.5, 9 years down the road, you get caught up with some federal stuff, you get arrested, right. That date, that arrest date, not the conviction date, the date of the arrest, if it falls within that window, it's a possible parole violation. And therefore, it is scored against the custody classification. So starting with the pre-sentence investigation report is the most important place to start, is making sure that the disposition on every single prior event is clearly documented. Telling us that no disposition found, which we see that in pre-sentence investigation reports, right? No disposition found does not mean dismissed, right? No disposition found means it wasn't entered into the FBI.
Right. Could be open, could be closed.
Yeah. Right. Now, what happens when you get to the bureau? The records office will go through the pre-sentence investigation report, and anything that looks open, they are going to send what's called a detainer action letter. Detainer action letter is actually a fill in the blank form, and it's going to mark off, hey, there was this charge in the pre-sentence investigation report, and they're going to include whatever information is in the pre-sentence report, the docket number, the conviction, the date, whatever information is available. They're going to include that on that form, and they're going to send it to that jurisdiction and say, hey, what do you want to do with this? What's the status of it? Do you want to lodge a detainer? And then they're going to wait. They're not going to make phone calls. They're not going to send emails. They're not going to send faxes. They're not following up. One of the things I was actually working on prior to my retirement was kind of beefing up that section, right? Because pending charges do interfere with SDA placement. And one of the things I wanted to see happen, and then I retired before it got churned out, but one of the things I wanted to see happen was more aggressive action on the part of the records office to follow up more frequently, whether that was monthly or quarterly. I wanted to see that followed up, because this leaving this charge out there, the Bureau can't make these agencies respond, right? And the way the policy is written now, they're not going to do anything else other than that initial letter that they send out. So
no, it's not the case manager doesn't have to, it's not their job to try to reach out and clear it, nope, or whatever. That's on the family, right?
Right. Now, when the unit management manual was updated, there is language in the unit management manual that talks about the case manager assisting the individual, the incarcerated individual. But assistance is in the form of setting up a legal call, right? If a person needs to reach out, it may be that agency needs verification of incarceration. I used to, as a case manager, do this all the time. Send a letter to the agency and just confirm this person was arrested on this date and has been in continuous confinement since. Or this person self-surrendered on this date, voluntary surrendered on this date, and has been in continuous confinement since. And it's just verifying their incarceration with the federal prison system. It may be setting up a call to an old probation officer. Again, that would fall under that legal call umbrella. But ultimately, the responsibility to resolve pending charges is on the individual. It is not on the case manager. It's on the individual. So like when we're talking to families, right, we're asking those questions. And sometimes it's the families that are going to the courthouses that are tracking down the documentation. And when it's sent in, the records office then has something, has a document in office. Maybe there's a phone number on the form, and we'll still have to verify it. But they're tracking, you know, the family is doing that legwork. And yes, we sometimes hear from families, the institution said it has to come from the courts. No, it just has to be verified. That's part of their job, is they would verify the documentation.
When you were in case management, did you ever tell the offender, hey, I'm starting to think about your community placement. I see you have some unresolved. You may want to get on that,
right? I talked about it at every team. And that was just something that I did, I would document at the first team, we'd talk about it and, you know, what's the status of it, you know, because when it comes to custody classification, let's take a step over before we talk about halfway house, an unresolved pending charge or detainer or an entry in a pre-sentence report that appears to be open will be scored against someone for approximately 17 months unless the documentation is received verifying that it's resolved, that it's been dismissed, or that the person was given time served, or that they were sentenced to a certain amount of time and it was run concurrent to the federal time, right? Whatever was done and it's closed. Otherwise, it's scored for 17 months. Now, where that 17 months comes from, first team, initial classification happens in 28 right. days. Program review is 6 months after that. That brings us to about 7 months. Custody classification is done at that 6 month, that first team, the program review, not the initial. And then custody classification is done annually after that. So by policy, they don't drop the points related to a possible detainer, an unresolved pending charge, parole violation, etc., until the second custody classification. Now, just because they drop the points doesn't also mathematically mean that
you go from a medium to a low or whatever.
Right. That doesn't automatically make it go away. And it really depends on the seriousness of it. I had cases where that and it was usually a violation. It was usually a parole violation, where the parole violation, the original case was pretty serious, right? And just because your points drop, because I can't score the points against you, I would turn around and do a management variable immediately. Mm-hmm. Haven't received it. It's for this. It's a parole violation. They haven't lodged a detainer yet. However, it's a violent offense. It's, you know, an offense involving a child, whatever it was, you know, whatever, if it was a serious enough offense, if the amount of the violation term was going to be significant, meaning if they ever lodge this detainer or if they just give it and run the time concurrently, it's going to exceed his federal time, right?
Right.
I would just ask for a management variable. So just getting the points dropped doesn't mean.
What management variable do you use?
It's greater security. It's where your points have dropped below your current level. So you're sitting in a low and your points have dropped a minimum, but there's still an issue. And
now, can the warden waive that or has to go through Grand Prairie or?
Has to go through Grand Prairie. All right. So one of two things can happen. So when someone's points drop, the unit team is either recommending a lesser security transfer to go to a camp, or if you're at a medium to a low, right? It's either recommending the transfer or recommending the management variable to keep them at their current level. So a lot of times what happens is still based on what level you're starting at, right? So if you're in a medium, right? If you're in a medium, they may still look at you to go to a low because you're still behind the fence. So there's still a perimeter security. If you're sitting at a low though, and your points drop, but there's still this possible parole violation out there, I'm not sending you to a open camp. So whether or not the institution pursues a management variable or allows for or requests the application, allows for the transfer or application of management variable, really depends on what level you're at and what level you're being considered for. And then it goes up to out to DSCC, out to Grand Prairie, Texas, and the designator makes the decision. The designator could concur with a management variable and place the variable and put an expiration of 1 year on it. They could disagree with it and approve the person for transfer. Same goes for a transfer. DSCC could disagree with the transfer and apply the management variable.
Okay.
So it's not like they magically go away because they get old.
No.
Now, when that detainer action letter goes out, and let's hypothetically say that agency lodges a detainer. A detainer is a formal hold. It's a piece of paper that comes back and says, don't release this person. We are going to come and pick them up when they finish their federal time. That can happen because they're still have prosecution pending. They still have a parole violation pending. Maybe they've been adjudicated, but the time is going to exceed their federal time. So it might be running concurrently, but you know, they've got this much federal time and that much state time, right? So we know right. The state time is running longer. Those are some of the different reasons that you will see an individual get a detainer lodged. And when that happens, you keep the points now, right? So you keep those points for that year and a half, that, you know, that first 19 months there when you're going to team. And then, or not 19, yeah, 19 months when you're going to team. And then we drop the points if they don't lodge the detainer. But if they lodge the detainer, then it's permanently applied. Excuse me. Once a detainer is lodged and it's official, right? Many individuals, some individuals will have the opportunity to file an interstate agreement on detainers, right? An IADA. If it's a qualifying charge and they're from a qualifying state, the records office will do an automatic notification to say, hey, you have these speedy trial rights. Do you want to pursue it? Now, I printed the policy because I can never remember the two states who are not part of the IADA, Louisiana and Mississippi. So if you've got a pending charge sitting out of, and that a formal detainer has been lodged, and it's sitting out of Mississippi or Louisiana, Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, not a state, but Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, or any of the other territories, you know, that are not one of the other 48 states.
Guam and all them, Saipan, Guam, all those. Right.
They are not a party to the IADA. Therefore, you can't request for a speedy trial under the IADA. What happens under that IADA is records office sends the person a notice and says, hey, are you interested in this? Right. And the person says yes or no. Now, there are two issues that create eligibility. The first is what state? You're not from Mississippi or Louisiana. The second is it's an untried charge. There's been an arrest. There is an open prosecution for which you have not been prosecuted before. That means probation and parole violations are not covered. These are for the new criminal conduct, that initial arrest. So if it's an untried charge from one of the other 48 states, you'll get that notice from the records office saying, hey, are you interested in an IADA? What happens there? You tell them yes or no. Most individuals, if they're eligible for it, they will get it done, right? Because that means it's resolved. That means you've got your attorney working for you on your behalf, trying to get you the best deal to get those charges. You know, maybe it's a time served or again, a sentence that's shorter than your federal sentence, but running concurrently, right?
Right.
So what happens is the Bureau will then, when the person says, hey, yeah, this is what I want, the Bureau puts together a packet of paperwork. Whole bunch of notices and forms. You'll get called down to the records office because you got to sign some of them. They put it together. They mail it out. That agency has 180 days to come get you. Okay. If they don't.
When did you mail it out? How far before the end of their?
Well, it depends. Depends when, and I know you're going with this, depends when the detainer is lodged, right? So the detainer's also, so if you remember, what did I say originally? The Bureau can't make other agencies respond. Do agencies out there wait until the person is at the tail end of their sentence before they lodge the detainer? Absolutely.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yep. Absolutely. Because they're going to have to come get them on a detainer for a pickup, but they're also going to have to come and get them for a writ. So if I'm sitting there in somewhere in the rest of the U.S., right, in a prosecutor's mm-hmm. office, and I am looking at untried charges that the Bureau knows about, right, because they sent me a letter and asked me about them, and this dude is sitting there, or this gal is sitting there with however long a sentence is, 32-month sentence. But I'm looking at a prosecuting and giving them 7 years. Do I want to say, lodge the detainer, them invoke, I send my guy, I issue the state, I do my stuff, issue the writ, I got to go pick him up, go back and forth, get him prosecuted, get the sentence, only to then lodge another detainer to go get them again when they finish their sentence to bring them back. It's a money thing. So yes, do prosecutors make that, weigh those decisions and wait to the end of a sentence before lodging a detainer? Wow. Yes, it happens.
Can you talk about immigration stuff when you did it? Did you have to do any immigration folks that were on your units?
Yeah. Yeah. So immigration is a completely different ball of wax.
And it is. It is. It is.
It's a completely different ball of wax. Let's for a second finish the state IED and then we'll start, jump over sure. to immigration briefly.
Sounds good.
So when they're making that decision of are they going to lodge a detainer, sometimes what an agency will do will be to respond back and say, can you lodge a notify? And a notify is in the months preceding you're finishing your sentence out, the Bureau is going to send a notification. And I believe it's done about 6 months in advance. It may actually be done less than that. I didn't look that up. I don't remember. Not important. It's done before a person's release. And it's done in plenty of time so that state can lodge a detainer. And again, once they get the notify, and if they're within that 6 months of their release, they can lodge the detainer. The person can invoke their IADA, their Eighth Amendment rights under IADA, and the prosecutors, the state has 6 months to come get you. But if you're only 4 months from release, what do you think is going to happen? They're going to wait till you finish your sentence and they're going to pick you up and they're going to do one trip, right? They're not going to do a round trip and then come get you again. That's what happens. So we see agencies, some lodge detainers, some will lodge what's called a notify. Okay, let's jump over to immigration for a second. So there have been several changes in recent years, going back to when I was a case manager and a case management coordinator. Detainers for immigration pickup were the detainer of last execution, right? So if I'm sitting here with a guy or a gal who has a detainer from the state of Texas and a detainer from immigration, right? They are going to be released to state of Texas first. State of Texas comes, picks them up, does their thing, and then Texas would turn them over to ICE or back in the day, INS, right? That's how that worked. For those of you young, not old enough to remember, what is
immigration
ICE
naturalization?
INS, National Relations and Immigration Naturalization Services. So we had INS agents that we worked with, not ICE agents back in the day. Post 9/11.
And it was interesting for our viewers to know that the INS was a component of the Justice Department, like the FBI and the DEA and ATF. So we were all brothers and sisters. Well, not so much with Homeland Security. It's a different...
Right. So post 9/11, Homeland Security got created and things got shoved, moved around, and agencies that were in different agencies kind of got like reorganized. Excuse me. And some of the immigration components were broken into smaller pieces to kind of focus on You know, when you and I started, like, it was INS and Border Patrol, and that was pretty much it, right? Mm-hmm. And now there's multiple immigration related agencies that have different responsibilities, whether it's the border or the ports of entry, whether it's handling immigration, whether it's handling removal. So they're kind of all, there's multiple things. But when an individual, again, comes into the system and the information they're going back to that towards the probation releases the documents to the marshals release it to the Bureau. What happens today, among other things, what happens today is daily a report goes from the Bureau to immigration officials and they review every person coming into the Bureau who is not a naturalized or by birth citizen to determine if they are going to need an immigration hearing. Not everybody is entitled to an immigration hearing depending on your legal status, your current legal status. And there's a whole bunch with that. And you and I aren't immigration lawyers, so we're not going to worry about that. But what they do is they tell the Bureau, yes, this person's going to need a hearing, or no, it's not. No, they're not. Or there needs to be more investigation. That information is given to the designation folks. So that is taken into account when designations are done. Now, talking about what we started talking about is immigration detainers used to be the detainer of last pickup. If you remember the Kate Steinle case, the Bureau took a lot of heat for the Kate Steinle case. For our viewers that don't recall, Kate Steinle was a young woman in California who was killed by a errant gunshot that came from a non-U.S. citizen who had an immigration detainer and had been in Bureau custody and then transferred to the state of California DOC, and they released him rather than turning him over. He was not convicted of causing her death, but he was involved in causing her death. From the Bureau standpoint, somehow the Bureau got blamed for that because, well, he had an immigration detainer. Why didn't the Bureau turn him over to immigration? Except the standard for decades...
That's right.
Was if a state had a detainer, if an inmate had a state detainers from two or three different states, he would literally get passed around until state everybody had their pound of flesh, whether it was prosecution or being served. And then whoever had him last turned him over to immigration. Well, of course, we know that depending on the politics of one state, certain states to this day decline to work with immigration in terms of honoring an immigration detainer. The Bureau does. So what happens today is, and this was as a direct result of that case, is every individual who has an immigration detainer and a detainer from another jurisdiction, the Bureau reaches out to immigration and says, do you want the person first or do you want to let the state have them? And then the Bureau looks at, or no, I'm sorry, not the Bureau, the immigration looks at where that person's detainer is. And if it is from a state that will not honor their detainers, that individual is probably going to immigration first. They're not going to let that situation happen again. And that's just a reality of it. So if you're sitting in a Texas prison, but you've got a detainer to California and you also have an immigration detainer, you're probably going to be deported rather than let the state of California, because even if they pick you up, they're not honoring immigration detainers and they're releasing the individual. And this is not a function of the current administration. I want to put that out there. This has been in place now with the Bureau for several years. I was actually still working in the regional office. It was before my last promotion to DC when that change came down. Because, like I said, the Bureau gets blamed, and it was California. But
before I became unit management section chief. But anyway, just flexing for you.
Yeah, before I did that, yeah, it came down, and there are sometimes there's things to happen, and you know, it's kind of funny in a sarcastic, obnoxious kind of way. Things will make it into the media because the other side is reporting on it, and it always used to frustrate me that the Bureau didn't defend themselves a little more, because of course I knew what was going on the inside. Had another situation with a detainer, not an immigration detainer this time, that had to do with a state who shall remain nameless. And we had two individuals that we had sent repetitive communication to, hey, what do you want to do with this guy? It looked like he owed them time, and it was for a violent offense in both cases. And the state didn't respond. Well, legally, when a person gets to their end of their sentence, the Bureau has no authority to hold them. We have to release them. Well, these two individuals actually happened within, probably less than 6 months of each other. And of course, then the state was mad. And so they had their article about the Bureau releasing violent offenders and not notifying the state and blah, 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 blah. But the Bureau we had, and they hadn't responded. As a result of that, those two particular cases, those were actually both Mid-Atlantic cases where I was located. Oh. And so that resulted in another change with regard to detainer notifications, where if a state doesn't respond timely, and it does appear that they're owed time, instead of the institution kind of being stuck trying to handle it when they've got another agency that's just not responding, that case gets elevated, and eventually can get elevated up to correctional programs in DC. And then we would help facilitate communication. So again, it was another situation where the Bureau got blamed for something and they weren't writing the story, right? And like I said, again, my little pet peeve about the Bureau not being a little bit more vocal on things. But those are two situations that caused a fundamental shift on how we manage those possible detainers, which is also part of the reason why when I was still working, I wanted to see an even more aggressive position taken to either get the documentation that there's going to be a detainer or get the documentation that there's not. In either case, we've got resolution. Once we get that resolution in, that in fact there is no detainer, there is no pending charge, well, then the person can get a lesser security transfer. Halfway house, you asked the question about halfway house, home confinement, all that pre-release planning, all of those things start to kick in. Under the Second Chance Act, a person will not go to halfway house or home confinement if they have unresolved pending charges. This has been a standard in the policy for decades, again. And there's language in there that essentially says if there's unresolved charges of conviction that could result in the arrest and or confinement of an individual, they're not going to be released to halfway house. Okay. And the very simple reason, and we've talked about in the past, when we talked about, jail credit and primary jurisdiction and who has the person, right? Mm-hmm. If an individual has an unresolved charge, is put in the halfway house, and let's say they go to the DMV to get a driver's license. Have you ever noticed at a DMV when you go to get your driver's license, there's always a law enforcement person in the corner? Absolutely. Why are they there? Because when you go to renew your driver's license, they check for wants and warrants.
Absolutely.
Every state in the union does it. Had a case, one of my cases, the local agency did not load the unresolved charge, the information, into the NCIC once and warned system. So we did our stuff. We did our checks both prior to the packet being completed, the halfway house packet being completed, did a second one prior to the furlough transfer. Everything was clean. There was nothing in the system.
Okay.
And he went to halfway house and he went to the DMV and he got arrested.
Oh, I got arrested. Okay.
Because he had a local charge, but it was never entered into the system. Okay. And oddly enough, this wasn't even in the PSR. It was a very weird situation. We had no information at all. Now, what happens if you get arrested when you're in halfway house? The Bureau loses jurisdiction. You are now in primary jurisdiction with the agency that arrested you. That means your federal time stops running. Now, they can be nice. Yeah, that's a problem. We call that in-op time, right? Inoperable time. You are just suspended. It is treated the same as an escape. We do code it as a technical escape, so we're not writing the person an incident report for escape. But it is a technical escape because the Bureau has lost primary jurisdiction.
And you're not doing a Marshall's flyer like I had to do for all my walkaways.
Oh, anyway. No. We still have to do notifies. We still have to do all of that.
Right. Okay. Good.
We're not doing that law enforcement flag that the person is a flight, but we still have to do, other stuff that has to be done. Right. We don't want law enforcement looking for someone when they're sitting in a jail over here. But the important thing is those days are dead. You sit there for a week. You're not in our jurisdiction. And a lot of times do the states return you to us? Yes, maybe eventually. But if you're in in-op status, you are in in-op status. So it's a problem. So to avoid that situation, we don't send people to halfway houses who have pending charges and detainers under the Second Chance Act. Now, what happened under the First Step Act? And this is, from a case management perspective, one of my many pet peeves with the First Step Act and the interpretation that has been made. So the First Step Act, as we all know, person gets their first 365 days applied to early release, and then any remaining time is applied to halfway house. Because Congress didn't say, in terms of pre-release placement, if eligible,
right?
They didn't add that if eligible. The previous administration made the determination that that meant the Bureau had to send someone to halfway house, even if they had a detainer or a pending charge from another jurisdiction. The Bureau had no choice. Now, what does that look like? As an example, I am sitting in prison. I'm serving a federal sentence, but I have a pending charge for an aggravated assault. But because I've not been convicted for it, right? It's not being scored as a history of violence. So there's no negative points there on my pattern, right? Remember, pattern and CASI classification are different. It's not my current offense. So I'm not being scored with a history of violence, or my current offense being violent. And again, the difference being custody classification versus pattern risk assessment. On my custody classification, I had a drug crime and this aggravated, and I was arrested for an aggravated assault, right? But the drug crime is eligible. This isn't a conviction. My classification is still scoring that violence as part of my classification, but there's no place that's being picked up in pattern. So I could absolutely be eligible for time credits and I'm earning this. And then I get my early release and I don't have a problem with that part. But now the Bureau was told, well, Congress didn't say if eligible, that means you have to send everybody.
Right.
So now I've got, because I had a pretty lengthy drug set charge, right? So now I'm sitting here and I've got, in addition to my 365 days of early release, I've got another 300-400 days of early halfway house placement. So now the Bureau has to. The previous administration said that's a must. The previous administration made the Bureau. So if you've seen change notice 1 and 2 on the First Step Act, that those were written by lawyers, not those, that language came to us. We have to put you in halfway house. So now you're sitting here with an aggravated assault pending charge, or maybe you were convicted of it, but because it was part of the instant offense, it's still not being scored against you as a history of violence because there was no break in custody. Another conversation. So I'm still getting my time credits, and now I get to go to halfway house for 400 days in the community when I've got this charge pending. And then I'm going to sit there in the halfway house for 400 days, taking up bed space for 400 days. And then the state's going to pick me up and take me and prosecute me. Like, it doesn't make any sense. It's a waste of resources. Mm-hmm. If anyone in the current administration were listening, I would love them to fix that. But it's a complete waste of resources. It's part of the reason that, and I know people had, some of our individuals that have shorter sentences that are now getting mm-hmm. home confinement aren't getting additional halfway house space, because these individuals that do have these unresolved pending charges or do have a detainer are actually being put in a halfway house. They are not being given home confinement. They are sitting in a halfway house the entire time, and they're taking up a bed the entire time because the Bureau, because the First Step Act didn't obligate home confinement. It just said pre-release placement. Right. The Bureau is still having to manage this person in an unsecured community-based halfway house program, and they're pending prosecution. And the folks that are working in halfway houses aren't law enforcement. They're just folks that have been hired to work the front desk. You know, is the Bureau going to expect them to stop this person who is like, yeah, pound salt, I'm out of here. You know, and now they're an actual escape and they're a violent offender and they have these charges. And then when something bad happens, the Bureau gets blamed for it because.
We're in
the funny papers. I can remember having a conversation with a meeting. And of course, when you're retirement eligible, your threshold for putting up with BS is substantially lower. And I was in a meeting and we were having this conversation about putting individuals into halfway houses that have detainers and pending charges. And I said to a person from the Office of the Deputy Attorney General, when this happens, not if, and there's another Kate Steinle, y'all are going to blame the Bureau and you're not going to take responsibility for making us do this. When it is poor correctional judgment, you are creating a community risk. And it was, we would not do that.
And we make decisions all the time for the orderly operation of an institution, all the time in the joint.
All the time.
Yeah.
And I find it hard to believe that the Congress, the individuals in the House, the Senate, when they were working on this bill, were like, oh, yeah, we don't care if they're eligible or not. Yeah, it doesn't matter if they've got a detainer for a violent offense. We're okay with them going halfway house because they earn these points. So anyway, I could complain about that all day, and I won't.
Five minutes.
I won't complain. It just drives me nuts when I think about it. But the pending charge, the detainer, and more importantly, the things that people don't think about is pending charges. It's easy to think about a pending charge when it's in the pending charge section of the pre-sentence investigation report. It's when it's in the criminal history section, when it's right. in the other arrests. I always love those other arrests.
It can be hiding in, yeah, it can be hiding in several places. Yes.
Yeah, it can be in several places. And this is where I say shame on defense attorneys for not paying attention to this. We get calls all the time from, we just had a call this past week where the person said, you know, the family member was saying, yeah, the attorney and the judge said that, you know, my loved one would be going to camp and they're designated to a low. And so we kind of were asking some questions, trying to kind of dig into, mm-hmm. they didn't have all of the answers, but you know, I can assure you the Bureau is not elevating people into higher secure facilities because they were bored. There was a reason. And so many times the reason is the PSR isn't correctly documenting or left information out. So working toward it, at a minimum, having the information in there. You know, if you're looking at federal sentencing and you're still in custody and the court date is there and you know that in 2 weeks I'm going to have this other court date, even if the disposition isn't known at that moment, having that in the pre-sentence investigation report at least gives the Bureau very specific information about what was already scheduled to happen. And I would argue if you have that gap, you know, you have that time, that gets resolved, like the attorney should be getting that information updated. And again, we hear it. The attorney said his job was done in sentencing. Well, if the pre-sentence report needs to be modified.
And that's why we need to get hired at the Green Book level, because if there are those loose ends, we can help get those tied up. We've seen some people. We have stopped some people from some horrendous situations because they hired us to go over the pre-sentence report. And we've had some high-powered lawyers, six-figure lawyers that we're saying, hey, man.
There's a problem.
You got a problem. You got a big problem here. And they're like, ooh, you know. Yeah. And anyway.
It was one little line here or there that they didn't see as an issue. I remember us doing a call we didn't have the lawyer on the call with it. It was one of the legal assistants. And it was like, oh, well, no, that was ABC. And I'm like, well, that's not what's documented. Right. It says disposition unknown. Disposition unknown means just what it says. It does not mean dismissed. And we see it all the time. And then we're the ones breaking it to the family. Well, this is what happened. This is what's, you know, this is what's there. And now you're after the fact trying to at least get the documentation into the Bureau so that then verifications can be made. But that all takes time.
Then there you go. It's a race against time and the halfway house. That, you know, oh, my God.
And nothing happens. Like everything ends up getting put on hold and you're screwed. And that is like the best way I can say it. So
perfect again, way to end the show.
In fact, in here, that in terms of the lawyer's obligation, defense attorneys, if you're listening, you are doing your clients a disservice by not understanding how the classification system works and those missed items, those incomplete, those vaguely worded, those are the things that hurt your client.
Boom.
Drop the mic.
Awesome. Well, very good, folks. Man, what a great show today was. Dr. Giddings is a wealth of information. Hearing
Thank
it,
you.
I mean, just nobody knows this better, I think. There's not very many people walking the face. Videos also on Facebook we have our Around the Block, Federal Prison Authority Around the Block podcast page that I've also meticulously loaded the episodes. We're also on Apple Podcast. Of course, you can go to LA Talk Radio and download the shows. We're on Amazon, Audible. So, wow, we just are so blessed to have the aggregation and the listeners and viewers that we have. We appreciate you. And always don't forget to reach out and contact us, email or comment on a thread or comment on a video and on Facebook. So, all right, everybody, we're over time. So have a blessed week, and we'll see you here next time on Around the Block. Take care, everybody. See you.
Bye-bye. Take care.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.